This week on the show, we show you a setup of diskless booting of a Raspberry Pi. TrueNAS abandons FreeBSD, and we cover that bunch. Then we have a big story about the SparkBook 3000 ST, how it was the coolest laptop of the 90s, how it goes into teardown, and the author comments as well. SSH over HTTPS for the people who want to tunnel everything over everything. Keycloak identity and access management on FreeBSD, a how-to from Vermidon. How Ford Aerospace and BSD Unix got involved with each other and how the Nagel algorithm played into that. And more in this week's episode of BSD Now. BSD Now, episode 552. The Laptop Spark, recorded on the 21st of March, 2024. This episode of BSD Now is brought to you by Tarsnap. Go to tarsnap.com/BSDnow to find online backup for truly paranoid people. And if you want to support this show in one way or the other, check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/BSDnow. And we thank you in advance for that. Hello, we are your hosts, Benedikt Reuschling.
And Tom Jones.
Oh yes, in high speed audio and video, the packets just come in as fast as possible from Tom's side.
Benedict's very jealous.
Just happy that
which is really funny. So my wife did a speed test, but I found out she did this. She was like, "Wow!" She did a speed test from her phone, and she's like, "That's like 10 times faster than the internet was before." And I was like, "Yeah, it is. But it's limited by the Wi-Fi, and the internet connection is 20 times faster than it was before." But
ooh, imagine the possibility. What internet is
what are the possibilities?
In high speed country? It's just your pet webpage loads.
They no longer get to blame it on the network. Woo-hoo. It's like other people are the problem.
Yeah, need to find new excuses now. Speaking of excuses, we have headlines for you this week. This is a bad bridge into, but yeah.
A great segue.
You're used to that. We start with a how-to. That's something new. But we found that this is good enough to be headline worthy. And this is the FreeBSD forums, actually, in the how-tos and FAQ section, which has a bunch of good user-written tutorials.
Why would someone do this rather
one
than like and submit something to the handbook? Do these things turn into the handbook?
It could become a handbook or an article on FreeBSD org, right?
That's cool.
That's not totally out of the question. Okay, so the how-to is about setting up diskless booting of Raspberry Pi running the RPi OS via TFTP and NFSv4 on a FreeBSD ZFS server. Interested? Let's go into it. So Peter Erickson, who wrote this, he has even a version for this one. Okay, so this is from last week, so we are fairly accurate and new on this one. Peter writes, below is a guide on how to set up a Raspberry Pi 4B running Raspberry Pi OS 12 for Pixie network boot with diskless NFS4 root running ZFS for past cloning of boot environments on a FreeBSD 13 server. So that's the setup. And he has a big beware at the beginning. This requires changing to syscuddles or CCDL kernel settings that enables use of UID and GID numbers over NFS4 protocol with sec equals sys. If you already use sec equals sys for other clients, then this might break stuff. If you don't do that, do you? But you don't do that, do you? So SEC or sec Kerberos 5 is the way to go, with a smiley at the end. Okay. So prerequisites, the environment that you need if you want to replicate or repeat this environment's tutorial. First, you need a FreeBSD server with ZFS data pool mounted on /export. That's his $z pool later on in the tutorial. You can put in your name that your pool is named. So the second, you need a Raspberry Pi, of course. And maybe you could use it with a different embedded board or with a physical server, but let's just go along with this. The third, a micro SD card. The fourth thing you need is a DHCP server that gives out IP addresses to the Raspberries, which is $client IP later on. So remember the server IP address as well. It all comes in handy. Step one, prepare the OS on Raspberry. Download the Raspberry Pi OS installer from raspberry.com/software and install the OS on an SD card. That's what you need here. Second, configure some OS customization settings. Not 100% needed, but it's nice to do. Some general stuff like set the host name, username, give that user a password, and enable SSH service so that you can connect to this via your favorite secure protocol. Third, write the OS to the SD card. Didn't we do that before? Yeah, oh, install the OS on an SD card. Yeah, that's maybe the same. Insert the SD card into your Raspberry and connect to a screen, a network, and a keyboard. And then number five, boot and log in as the admin user on the Raspberry. Then on number six, update the operating system with update. Why do we have... Ah, I see. This is the FreeBSD forums and we're using apt? Okay. Let's just go along. That's for the Raspberry Pi OS. So that's what we have. Run update, apt upgrade dash Y, and get and save the Raspberry Pi serial number. That's vcgenCD, the command otp_dump, grep28: and then set that line. It's all given there, so you don't need to remember this. And just copy it from the forum entry that we list to from our show notes. Get and save the MAC address and IP as well. So IPA list. So that's needed for the TFTP later on so that it knows which MAC to connect to. Number nine, in order to successfully be able to NFS mount from an FSv4 server, a hack or hook needs to be installed in the init RAMFS image since the default user libklibc/bin/mfs-mount binary only supports NFSv2, oh, that's old, or NFSv3. However, the normal user sbin-mount.nfs binary is compatible and works on the hooks, replacing nfs-mount with mount.nfs. So he provides a script to replace that, and remember to make it executable, the script later on. After that, run the update in ramfs-u-v. Then, in number 10, step 10, configure boot order via raspi-config, where you say, yeah, please boot from the network first, and some other stuff. So that's the order in which the boot devices should be looked for. Reboot once the EEPROM is reflashed and leave the SD card in the Raspberry. Step 2, prepare some NFS shares on the file server and the TFTP server. That's where FreeBSD comes in. Activate the kernel NFS settings. So you need to do vfs.nfsd.enable_string to UID equals 1 and the same for enable_UID to string equals 1. Activate them manually. So cctl -p, you could run that. I learned that recently. You can run sysctl-p to reapply everything that's in your sysctl conf. But you can also do it on the command line with sysctl and the sysctl name equals the value. Create /export/tftp-boot and /export/netboot directories. Of course, you do that with ZFS. You create a little data set for it and set directly the share NFS property with sec equals sys, as mentioned at the beginning. Sec equals sys RO, so read only, and maproot equals root, both for the TFTP boot and the netboot dataset. Then create a template directory for the data from the Raspberry Pi. That's another ZFS dataset below the netboot and TFTP boot. Both have a subdataset called template, and both also are sharing. Ah, this is a different share NFS setting. This is not just inheriting stuff from their father data set or mother data set, but this has sec equals sys, and this one is read-write. The template ones need to be read-write, and they have maproot root with the client IP of the Raspberry Pi in there. Okay, so that's the difference. Then enable the TFTP server by saying tftpd enable equals yes and tftpd_flags equals /export/tftp-boot. Then service tftp start. Then you run the NFS server or enable that with NFS server enable equals yes and NFSv4 server enable equals yes as well in rcconf. Then do mount d enable equals yes as well and then start the NFSD service and the mount d service in that order. Then copy all the files from the Raspberry to the server, mount -t NFS, so that's where you mount the NFS share, /mount, and then you rsync everything from /root to that mount, so that everything goes there, as well as permissions and flags and everything that belongs to it. Then you unmount that share and repeat the step for first we did the netboot, and then we unmounted that, and now we mount the TFTP boot template directory where we can write. So we do another rsync of /boot/firmware to it, and then unmount that as well. Step four, then we disable NFS sharing of the template directory and make an initial client clone. That's where you say ZFS set share NFS off for netboot /template and TFTP boot /template. Then we clean up the template etc fs tab and make a snapshot to be used for clones, because we are clever and use ZFS this way. So we add a proc file system to export /netboot/template/etcfstab. Then make a template snapshot to be used as a source for cloning of the clients. That is just a set of a snap away, and it's handily named at default, both for netboot and TFTP boot. So that's just the same every time. Step seven, make a clone of that template we just created the snapshot from, ZFS clone, with the same settings, share NFS, because that clone also needs to have these settings, and it just doesn't inherit them, apparently, or we just be very explicit about that. And then we have the clone now. Modify some files in the client root, so we need to make sure that the host name is different and the mail name is different. So that's etc hostname and etc mail name respectively. And etc host needs to be changed to the new host name, because they shouldn't be having the same name, because networks are picky about this. And then we echo the server IP /tftpboot and the serial number and boot /firmware. So that's where the booting happens in etcfs tab. So that's where it looks, hey, at this server IP, you are expecting your boot firmware and boot from there. Then you set up the TFTP boot code, difficult word, tongue twister alert. Etc export, you copy the netboot /template/boot/firmware boot code bin from the previous directory into the local etc or the export TFTP boot, and make that executable, readable, and you do a symlink to make that easier for the serial number, and then later on point the NFS root to the server in command line.txt. That's a very long line. I'm not reading that here. You can all find it in the how-to. Step 11, second to last step. This varies depending on the DHCP server, because you need to configure that. Used by following settings, you need the pixie and bootp settings enabled, so that boot file is bootcode.bin. The next server is the server IP we have earlier written down. Then IPv4 DHCP options, vendor encapsulated options, that's a very long hex address or the MAC address, as well as the vendor class identifier, which is pixie client. The vendor encapsulated options is required, or the Raspberry will not attempt to download the bootcode bin file from the TFTP server. And it's basically the equivalent of the string Raspberry Pi boot. Okay, that's where it's coming from. Last step, remove the SD card from the Raspberry and power cycle it. And ideally, if you've done all the steps correctly, now it should boot from the network. Cool. Thanks for this.
Next, we have an article from the Register. How to. Written by Liam Proven. And this is TrueNAS Core 13 is the end of the FreeBSD version. Debian-based TrueNAS Scale is the future primary focus. Bad news from BSD land. The oldest vendor of BSD systems is changing its direction away from FreeBSD toward Linux. NAS vendor IX Systems has been very busy this year, but apart from some statements in online user communities, it hasn't been talking about the big news. Back in 2022, we covered TrueNAS Core 13. The new release of its free BSD-based turnkey OS for NAS servers, and in the article we mentioned its new product, the Debian-based TrueNAS Scale, aimed at providing storage for Kubernetes users. Now it seems the company is betting its future on that Linux-based product, meaning the end is in sight for its FreeBSD offering. TrueNAS Scale is apparently thriving. Gartner recently handed IX Systems a gong for customers' choice in storage. I don't know what that means. With some VMware users feeling uncomfortable at Broadcom's takeover and assessing alternatives, many TrueNAS customers told the company they were considering KVM. Meanwhile, the company released version 13.10 of the Debian-based TrueNAS Scale. It even found time to donate its fast dedupe feature to the FOSS world. Good for IX Systems and good for TrueNAS Scale, but what about, if you'll pardon the pun, its core offering? It's called TrueNAS Core 13 because it's based on FreeBSD 13, and that came out in April 2021, and earlier this month, the developers released the latest update, FreeBSD 13.3. TrueNAS Core 13 users, including this vulture, are still waiting for the 13.1 release, which is still shown as an unstable build on the company's software releases page, with nary a hint on the status page. TrueNAS Core evolves from the older FreeNAS first appeared in 2005, based on the monowall firewall with a web GUI written in PHP. Under IX Systems, FreeNAS got a whole new UI in version 11, which is still used today. A fork of the original FreeNAS, updated with FreeBSD current components, continues as the Zigma NAS project. The creator of PCBSD and former co-host of this podcast, Chris Moore, is still with IX Systems, and he's now Senior VP of Engineering. He's also active on Reddit under the handle u/kmore134. Back in December, he told the TrueNAS subreddit, "Right now the plan for Core is to release a 13.1 Q update in Q1 2024. This will be a maintenance-only type update, which includes an update to the FreeBSD base, OpenZFS, and Samba. No new features are expected." That's looking dated now. 13.1 came out in May 2022 and reaches end of life in July 2023, really replaced by FreeBSD 13.2. More continued, "We have no plans for a FreeBSD 14-based TrueNAS at this time, and the 13.1 release will be a longer-lived maintenance train for those who want to continue running on the BSD product before migrating to scale later at some later date." This sounds swapping between the author and Chris Moore. "This sounds bad. We asked the company if this was true, and marketing VP Mario Blandini confirmed it, telling the Register, 'TrueNAS Core is entering its sustaining engineering phase with the TrueNAS project. TrueNAS scale within the TrueNAS project is where new features and updated components are developed and tested. Some of those are eligible for backporting to TrueNAS Core, and Core users can migrate to scale to take advantage of new features. There will be one more update to Core. Next up for TrueNAS Core is 13.3, which can give you some early detail on before it's released next month, based on FreeBSD 13.3. Among TrueNAS features, it will include updates to ZFS as well as an upgrade of Samba to version 4.19 to maintain feature parity with the next release of scale. The 13.3 wishlist, which I didn't look at, contains more details of the updates to expect. There is an upgrade path because of the way TrueNAS works. The OS is kept in its own dedicated drive. The company recommends a fast SSD that is not shared with the network and indeed cannot be. Thanks to ZFS snapshots, it's possible to do an in-place migration, although it's a one-way process. Both FreeBSD and Linux editions use the same ZFS file system, so the new OS can pick up and migrate the settings from the old one. What it can't bring across is VM appliances. TrueNAS Core plugins run in FreeBSD jails or under the Beehive hypervisor, whereas the VMs you can create in TrueNAS scale run inside the Linux kernel's KVM. These are not interchangeable. This is significant and sad news because IX Systems grew out of the original BSD vendor, Berkeley Software Design Inc., which sold BSD/386, not to be confused with 386 BSD, the first commercial BSD-based OS for commodity hardware. We described the early history of BSD when we looked at FreeBSD 13.1. The company had a long, complex history involving multiple mergers, sell-offs, and reacquisitions, including Walnut Creek CD-ROM. The Unix market has been turbulent and troubled for many decades, and under its various names, the company has a long history of divestments, acquisitions, and indeed, shutting products down. After merging with Walnut Creek, it sold off its OS division to Wind River, which then sold off FreeBSD part of the business as FreeBSD Mall, which IX Systems acquired in 2007. Soon after its 2006 acquisition of PCBSD, a desktop-focused FreeBSD distro. In 2009, the developer FreeNAS moved to a Linux-based system, which developed into OpenMedia Vault. IX Systems stepped up and took over FreeNAS development. It also continued to work on its desktop version, which in 2016 it renamed TrueOS. In 2020, it discontinued TrueOS and combined FreeNAS with its TrueNAS line. For the company, this move doubtless makes sound commercial sense, although the Reg Foss desk remains skeptical about whether most of its users actually need Kubernetes. It remains popular and adoption continues to grow. Many companies have hitched their future to this bandwagon and gotten rich. For IX Systems, it seems like a small fish choosing to jump into a big pond, and we're concerned what might happen if the wave of microservice hype crests and dissipates. One of the advantages of FreeNAS, whether it is simple and frugal with resources, like Zigma NAS, it is installed on a USB key, meaning that upgrading was simple as writing a new a new image to a new key. In our briefings with the company, we've repeatedly reminded IX Systems of this and requested the return of that feature, but the company's representatives didn't seem to understand why it was desirable. 11 years ago, we wrote about how aiming for enterprise customers lost Novell's small business heartland. We are concerned that IX Systems risks the same fate. One of the problems with ZFS on Linux is that because it's not part of the kernel, its cache must remain separate from the Linux kernel's own cache, which is a key advantage for bcachefs. We have no fewer than three old HP microservices around with a grand total of 22 gigabytes of RAM between them. This means that TrueNAS scale is little use to us, and we suspect many other small deployments. There are already mutterings about a fork, and we'll be watching this area closely. Oh, I didn't see that. I don't know. Do we have opinions? I don't know anything about TrueNAS.
We have them, but we don't always voice them. That's the problem with this world, right? Everyone has an opinion. This isn't live. Can't shut up about it.
If we're completely batty, you can just cut all this out, and we'll look good. But I don't know. Like, I've spoken to many companies that have done migrations the other way, coming from Linux to FreeBSD, especially in the wake of IBM pulling very hard on Red Hat, and therefore Red Hat derivatives and CentOS being killed. And I spoke to companies that they were pushed down a technical line because of the way a distribution was, and rather than succumb to that, they moved to FreeBSD because it was offered a very stable platform. FreeBSD is inherently unable to track the development of hardware in the way that the Linux can, because Linux has one mindshare here, and we get first party support for a lot of hardware. And I could understand that if your users are requesting features which aren't possible in FreeBSD without a lot of engineering effort, that you would then want to switch. Like, if you want to run Kubernetes or you need to run Docker, like, need is a funny part there. Like, if you need to run Docker, if you have a competitor where Docker is a feature, then that might make you want to do that. And so I can see where a company, I'm not going to speak about IX Systems because I don't know anything about them. I can understand why a company would say, well, if we're going to employ four engineers, they could be chasing features on FreeBSD, or they could be adding new features on Linux because all of the stuff is there. But that erases all of the benefits of FreeBSD. Like, it says it's not a stable platform, and there's a lot to running an OS in production, which is difficult to do, and it's much more than just the ability to have hardware you support. So yeah, I don't really know where they land. I can see, like, if they need investment, it'd be very hard to say you're a FreeBSD-based platform, because there's always negatives.
Yeah.
So yeah, it would be wonderful to know what the internals were, but we won't find them out for 20 years, and we might find out what happened, like, far in the future. And if IX survives this, that's great. I mean, I don't know why they shouldn't.
Yeah.
I don't know anything about their business model or how they get money. It's sad to see any platform stop using FreeBSD, because it's a great platform. I'm very fond of it. Paid for this green room I'm sitting in. Yeah, of course we're biased.
And we're biased, of course.
You know, more diversity there is good. And it was always a lot of exposure to FreeBSD from people. Yeah, I don't know. Like, they've been very, like, there's no communication here at all. And I guess it's in their benefit because there's nothing to point at.
Yeah,
but it doesn't help anyone who's been involved. And I don't know why you would
most people
build anything on top of this now if they're not going to communicate what they're doing. Like, why would you build another NAS system here when you've got a million other options?
Yeah. I guess the biggest surprise, or what a lot of people have seen coming, if they gotten one of their products, whether it's TrueNAS Core, Corral, or whatever box they have, or even just the software part, then they need to ask themselves, hey, is there a migration path either to the non-FreeBSD version, or away from that? I mean, I could always copy my data to another system or to another pool on a non-IX Systems thing. But is that so easy, and how do I actually make that without losing the data and getting everything off that supposedly vendor lock-in?
Yeah, and
so that's the question.
I don't really understand how it fits in the market, because if it fits as a storage appliance, then you're now in a really bad position as a company, because your storage appliance is end of life. And so if this means you don't trust them anymore as a company and you need to move away, well, you need another storage appliance. And at some point, maybe you just want to white box this. And with FreeBSD, like true NAS to FreeBSD, you could always just white box it and you maybe lose some of the user interface stuff, but you would still have FreeBSD in the end. And I can see an upgrade path.
Yeah, in there, yeah. There is, yeah, probably a way. And since they target now the Kubernetes and, as you mentioned, Docker, that's their market and that's what they target off. And if that's not what other people need for home users or a small company, then of course, then they ask themselves, is that still a valid platform or do we still get the same support that we have come to use?
Yeah. Or have, I mean, it's a great way to, the argument that you could have engineering time spent on features rather than maintenance, allied to the fact that maintenance needs to be done right on the platform. And it seems more like an opportunity just to get rid of the engineers that would have done the maintenance because you don't need to keep them anymore. So
yeah, to move them we'll to see new features. Too early to tell. And we'll keep you posted.
If it was any other company, I'd be like, I hope somebody leaks a story out, but I'm not sure we'd cover a leaked story here because we're too like intertwined.
We'll see. Then we have the news roundup, and this is for the historians or those who want to reminisce a little bit from the good old days, quote unquote. The SparkBook 3000 ST, the coolest 90s laptop. That's from this blog post here from jasoneckert.github.io. And Jason writes, a few weeks back, I managed to pick up an incredibly rare laptop, immaculate condition, for $50 on Kijiji, whatever name that is, a Tadpole Technologies SparkBook 3000 ST from 1997. So that's old, and I feel old as well. It also came with two other working Pentium laptops from the 1990s, so that's just a little nice extra on top. So the author had to drive almost 3 hours to pick it up on the other side of Toronto, but for SparkBook, it was definitely worth it, seeing as they are more likely to find the lost city of Atlantis than another one of these again. So what makes the coolest laptop of the 90s? Well, basically the specs. So for those who remember, 170 megahertz, so not giga, megahertz, Fujitsu Turbo Spark CPU, fastest Spark CPU before everyone moved to the 64-bit Ultra Spark platform, as well as the Sun's Open Boot Prom. A whopping 128 megabytes, kids, that's megabytes, not gigabytes, 128 megabytes of RAM. In 1997, this was unimaginable in the laptop. Sun Microsystems Solaris 2.5.1 Unix installed with the open Windows and desktop environment. A slim magnesium alloy body that is military grade. This thing is entirely metal, except for the ergonomic handrest. There's pictures on the blog posts, and you can definitely see that this is a heavy-looking machine. An IBM ThinkPad keyboard is also in there. IBM was an early investor in Tadpole. They have built-in ISDN, remember that? Ethernet, PCMCIA, that is really old. External SCSI and keyboard, mouse, VGA, and sound in and out port. So what more do you need? An LCD readout of system status and a price tag of $21,000. Ooh, my. Okay, Sun computers were an expensive desire for many computer geeks in the 1990s, and running Unix on a Spark-based laptop was, well, just as cool as it gets. Spark was an open hardware platform that anyone could make, and Tadpole licensed the Solaris Unix operating system from Sun for their Spark books. Tadpole essentially made high-end Unix or Max workstations on costly, unusual platforms like PowerPC, the DEC Alpha, or Spark. But only their Spark books were popular in the high-end Unix market of the 1990s. So they brought this thing home and tried to find a power supply that would work. Unfortunately, it takes a very strange diameter power plug and power requirements, 12 volts at 4.6 amps. So they went on eBay, and out of sheer luck, someone in New York was selling an original SparkBook power supply in mint shape for $30 for exactly this kind of people who need it. A week later, it arrived and they were ready to go. The picture to the left was taken a few seconds before turning it on. So just to see where this started on, They wanted one last picture in case it caught on fire. But okay, it didn't do that, so it booted up right away and immediately interrupted the boot process. Pause A to interact with the open boot prompt. The banner command showed the installed RAM, and once they ran set defaults, followed by reset, the system booted to the Solaris 2.5.1 installation of the hard disk. There's a video on YouTube to see how it boots. The only problem, they didn't have the root password. Normally, this isn't a problem because you can boot a Solaris installation CD or network image and clear the root password in the etc shadow file. But they have no SCSI CD-ROM that they can plug into the external SCSI port or on the SparkBook, and the Ethernet port on the back is actually an ISDN port. The real Ethernet port on the back is a weird custom high-density port that goes to an AUI, so no luck there. But then they remembered that the SparkBook 3000 models used an IBM IDE 2.5-inch hardware, and they HDD, yeah, so that's a non-flash disk. Disk drive, and they have an old USB to 2.5-inch IDE enclosure that they keep from years ago. Better yet, they also have a Sunblade 1500 running Solaris 10 that has lots of USB ports. And so the author here went ahead and removed 2.5-inch floppy, HDD, that's HDD, not a floppy, from the SparkBook, added it to the USB enclosure, popped it into the Sunblade 1500, and mounted the slice layout on the hard disk. Even if it didn't already know Solaris, the SparkBook manual that they downloaded details everything possible about the hardware and the Solaris operating system, including the default slice layout. So where you can see where's the swap, where's your var, where's slash opt, and so on. And how big they typically are in megabytes. Again, this is from the 1990s. First thing they did was make a complete clone of the hard disk, so in case they needed that, then they popped the 2.5-inch HDD back into the SparkBook, and they booted up, voila, no root password needed. So that's where they did the edit etc password edit, of course, on the other system. So, of course, before modifying etc shadow, they made a backup of it so that it could later crack the passwords in it using John the Rip. Ah, yes, of course, yeah, why not? While the accounts for the developers were authenticated across the network using NIS, no local password hashes stored, the original root password on a SparkBook was, drumroll, CTLAdmin. Perhaps CTL stood for Computing Technology Lab. And the only other local account was called DNSPTest and had a password of 1GTAFFAR, T-A-F-F-A-R. So, people who have that password, change it now. So they guessed here that that 1GTAFFAR would perhaps stood for One Great Affair, but we will never know. They have two more or three more videos on YouTube, actually. You can check out those so to see a bit more of the machine doing stuff. And then they go a little bit deeper into this machine. So the question there is, what are they going to use this SparkBook for? Well, for starters, the next presentation they give to a Unix or Linux-oriented group is going to be given from this SparkBook. Excellent. For shock and novelty value. After all, it has VGA output for a projector and a suite of Office programs. Oh, yes, go wild there. Of course, they cleaned up the project that the previous owner had, removed any software packages they'll never use to free up space on the file systems. They keep the original JDK web and Sybase servers for posterity, though. Remove the old user accounts and NFS configuration, change the host name to Sparky, set the default shell to bash, and installed Doom. Because, of course. Stopped any services as well, and they didn't need to speed up the boot process, so to make that happen, they stop those, as well as spice up the boot desktop a bit to their liking. The background is made up of miniature Sun logos now. Okay, so that's the first part of this, because the author also did the teardown. That's the SparkBook teardown. So where they also have pictures from the inside, the innards, where they refer back to where they picked up the Spark machine, and they've always been curious to see the internals, they write. And while there have been a few teardowns of the SparkBook 3 series, they couldn't find any on the SparkBook 3000 series at all. So they decided to do one themselves. In short, it's a very simple teardown to do. There's no internal frame that holds each component. Instead, all components connect in some way to the bottom of the laptop, which is made of rigid magnesium alloy. To open the laptop, you only need to remove three screws. Oh, Apple, that's how we did it back then. sorry, that's just my personal take. So remove 3 screws from the bottom of the laptop, 2 under a small plastic lifts on the either corner and 1 in the middle under the rubber pad. You can then lift the LCD and hinge assembly away from the body, which is also allowing you to remove the plastic plate covering the rear ports. They did this while the laptop was seated on its side so that it could safely examine the connectors inside. The daughter board holding the LCD status display and the red power button switch is what the 3 keyboard ribbons cable connect to. Once those cables are disconnected, you can slide the entire top assembly, which is the keyboard and handrest, forward and remove it. Oh, that's good repairability. iFixit would have liked that. The underside of the ThinkPad keyboard indicates that it's a Keytronic UO4056US. Keytronic bought Lexmark's tooling after they exited the keyboard business in early 1996 and continued making laptop keyboards for IBM and Tadpole. Okay, so they cleaned it a little bit of dust and other stuff. And here you can find other interesting things. There are 2 main circuit boards on the SparkBook that are sandwiched together. Motherboard, which is affixed to the bottom of the laptop, and a CPU board, which plugs into the motherboard via 2 custom SCA-style connectors. So they also show a couple of components, some of the daughter boards where the disk sits next to the CPU heatsink, and the PCMCIA cache is also quite big. If you remove 1 more screw as well as 3 of the riser screws, you can lift the motherboard away from the bottom of the laptop. The reverse of the motherboard reveals the Wayetech graphics chip as well as the associated pallet DAC and video RAM. There's also a custom Tadpole controller that handles laptop-specific functionality, such as the PCMCIA, sleep, battery, brightness controls, Sun-based S-Bus I/O controller. It also interfaces with the settings of the EEPROM chip directly above it and a 16-bit multimedia audio codec. All right. They go a little bit more into the serial numbers of each device or each thing they took out of the thing, but that's not too interesting, I guess. Final thoughts here, they say they were most surprised to see Sun-branded chips inside the Tadpole SparkBook. Aside from the IDE controller and custom Tadpole controller, all of the chips they outlined are also commonly used in Sun Spark stations. As a result, they think the designers of the SparkBook thought more about the lines of, let's figure out how to fit a Spark station into a laptop chassis, instead of, let's figure out how to create a Spark laptop. This makes sense since the latter would likely be far more expensive to do, and the SparkBook is already insanely expensive. While the SparkBook was by far Tadpole's most successful product, Sun Systems ruled the 1990s Unix workstation market, remember? Tadpole also created a DEC Alpha laptop running VMS, an RS6000 laptop running AIX, and even a Pentium laptop running SUSE Linux. It's probably safe to assume that most of the chips in those systems mirror the same ones in the desktop workstations they were based on. So from looking online, the chassis design is nearly identical across these models, as well as between the SparkBook 3000 series and earlier SparkBook 3 series. They couldn't help but be impressed by the design while they were performing the teardown. It's quite clear that a great deal of thought and development went into this aspect alone. And considering that the SparkBook is insanely thin for its time, the design focus is certainly paying off. And yet another article before we finish with this is the author comment on Hacker News. They have sparked a little bit of a discussion going back and forth that we just leave for you if you're more interested in the Spark machine. And so a couple of people were appreciative of them using these old hardware systems for various things.
I mean, the second article is definitely worth looking at just to see the pictures. I've always had this dream of taking like a G4 PowerBook to a conference and sitting next to somebody from Apple and just opening it and just acting like nothing is going on. I think it'd be really fun.
You have to go with the times.
Okay, next up we have something much more modern, but also quite strange, SSH over HTTPS. And this comes from trophy.github.io. TLDR, to pass SSH through HTTPS, you need to tweak the client and server sides as the following. There's a lot of config in here. There's a example SSH config file with a host SSH via HTTPS, proxy command, which links to a shell script called httpstunnel.bash, and a firewall and a keep alive to keep firewalls happy. The tunnel.bash script is a printf, and it says printf connect SSH server colon 22 HTTP HTTP, and it cats it, and it connects through SOCAT to do this. And then there's some Apache config. Here we allow everyone to use connect HTTP method on the server side hosted at HTTPS server just for a single target, the SSH server host. And on the client side, we can use SOCAT to create TLS connection with a send connect method as a header. Now you can use SSH via HTTPS to reach the SSH server. More words. Background. Why do I need it? I plan to spend 1 to 2 days in hospital and did not plan to use the laptop. But now I am stuck here for the past 2 weeks and I'd like to tinker on small stuff remotely. The hospital has free Wi-Fi. The caveat is that the hospital blocks most connection types. It allows you only to do HTTP, TCP port 80, and HTTPS, TCP port 443, connections for most hosts, DNS on UDP port 53, and DOT, TCP port 853, seem to work as well for at least well-known DNS providers. But SSH, TCP port 22, is blocked completely. I wondered how hard it would be to pass SSH through HTTP or HTTPS. I had a GSM fallback. That link? No. I had a GSM on fallback so I could reconfigure my remote server side and try various solutions. The options. There are various avenues to explore here. One, co-host SSH and HTTPS protocols on a single port and dispatch them transparently. SSLH project does just that. One of its features or limitations is that it doesn't encapsulate one protocol on another. It guesses the protocol using various heuristics and redirects them to the actual backend, SSH server, HTTPS, or any other supported protocol from the list. Clear pro here is no special SSH configuration is required, but there's minor cons. There's an extra service to set up. HTTPS has to be passed through SSLH as well, which might hide source address of the connections for the backend, not convenient for logging and possible performance. Option two, encapsulate one protocol completely in another. OpenSSH supports the proxy command directive, effectively allowing the user to supply any transport that SSH protocol uses. Clear pros are full encapsulation of one protocol another, no heuristics, harder to block, by DPI software. HTTPS is not impacted or redirected. The cons could be substantial. Performance decreases due to double encryption, requires configuration to use the proxy. I went with option two, fully encapsulate SSH in TLS. Before doing that, I tried a simpler SSH over HTTP. I configured Apache 2 to allow connect method for a single host. Using the above SSH via HTTP command is enough to use port 80 to connect to SSH. I use server live interval to work around some kind of silent idle HTTP connection closure somewhere in the transit. I tell OpenSSH client to periodically send probes to the server to make HTTP connection look alive. That way, an idle session can stay alive for longer periods of time. By default, HTTP uses timeout 60 seconds of no IO as a signal to close the tunnel. SSH over HTTPS. For some reason, SOCAT does not support HTTPS proxy via connect method and only supports HTTP. A minor omission, or do I hold SOCAT wrong? Luckily, SOCAT supports TLS encapsulation. Connect-based method is made easy to implement manually by a shell script. Now we can implement the script for SSH over HTTPS tunneling. Parting words. Ubiquitous presence of HTTPS allows you to pass your data through very restrictive middle boxes. The connect method, while seemingly being a remnant of the far past, is a useful hack to wrap any TCP payload stream into a TLS host stream. The server live interval OpenSSH knob allows you to keep the connection alive if the underlying transport is not friendly to idle connections. Have fun. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, this is interesting. So, next up in our journey through this episode, we have the Keycloak Identity and Access Management on FreeBSD, which is one of many of Vermadan's, I hope that's properly pronounced, articles. He always goes into much detail, a lot of information given in how-tos and also in regular weekly posts, where he also mentions us as a podcast. So that's our appreciative ping back, I would say, to many of his posts. So this one is about the creating a key cloak identity and access management server. And he goes through the full setup and shows how to set that up and configure it as well. And Alexander Leidinger from FreeBSD also has a couple of good comments about SSO, OIDC, and SAML providers in the comments. But definitely good shout out to Vermidon and his attention to detail here. And if you are in the need of setting up a Keycloak server, then follow this how-to. This is definitely
okay. Last in the news roundup this week, we have a Hacker News comment. I don't know who's by. Their username is Animats. They write, Ford Aerospace was one of the first commercial sites of BSD Unix. The licensing was complicated. We had to buy Unix 32V from AT&T first. That transaction got on the path for major corporate documents. AT&T and Ford Motor had a cross-licensing agreement. Eventually, I got a no-cost license agreement embossed with the corporate seals of both the Ford Motor Company and the American Telephone and Telegraph Corporation. I made a copy and taped it onto the VAX. Then I drove up to Berkeley from Palo Alto and Bill Joy gave me a BSD tape. BSD didn't have networking at the time. We bought 3Com's UNET, that was TCP IP written by Greg Shaw, $7,300 for a first CPU, $4,300 for each additional CPU. It didn't use sockets. You opened a connection by opening a pseudo device. You know, UNET itself was in user space, talking to the other end of the pseudo device. Once we got that going, we had it on VAX machines, some PDP-11s, and some Zilog Z8000 machines. The Zilog Z8000 was roughly similar to a PDP-11, all of which, along with some other weird machines, including a symbolic list machine, eventually interoperated. We had some of Dave Mills' fuzzballs as routers and a long-haul link to another Ford location that was connected to the ARPANET. Links included 10 megabit a second Ethernet, a DAC device called a DMC that used triaxial coax cables, and serial lines running SLIP. A dedicated 9600 baud serial synchronous line to Detroit was a big expense. My work in congestion control came from making all this play well together. All these early TCP/IP implementations did not play well as well with others. Network interoperability is assumed now, but it was a new, strange idea back then. In an era where a major corporate computer maker had its own networking protocols, UNET as delivered was intended to talk only to other UNET nodes. I had to write UDP and ICMP and do a major rewrite on TCP. When BSD got networking, it was initially intended to talk only over Ethernet to other BSD implementations. When 4.3 BSD came out, it could only talk to other implementations during alternate 4-hour intervals. I had to fix the sequence number arithmetic, which wrapped incorrectly. And finally, it all worked. For a few years, it was said of the TCP/IP internet that it took too many PhDs per packet. One day on the Stanford campus, I saw a big guy with a tool belt carrying an Ethernet bridge, a sizable box in those days, under his arm. I thought this was finally a working technology. Oh, it's John Nagel. Okay. Yeah, okay.
Cool.
Yeah, John Nagel. Nice kind history. Of important.
Yeah.
It's amazing the Nagel algorithm. I mean, nominative determinism at play there, that he discovered the Nagel algorithm and then was able to apply it. And his name was John Nagel. Yeah, really good.
Okay, great history tidbit there. Jumping into Beastie Bits, we have news from the OpenBGPD project. 8.4 has been released, and that comes from the Routed in a Route Bordering Department on the undeadly.org OpenBSD Journal. So the announcement from Claudio Yeager goes, we have released OpenBGPD, now I have it correct, 8.4, which will be arriving in the OpenBGPD directory of your local OpenBSD mirror soon. This release includes the following changes to the previous release. Rewrite of the internal message passing mechanism to use a new memory safe API. The next is rewrite most protocol parsers to use the new memory safe API. Convert the update parser, all of the RTR, as well as both the MRT dump code in BGPD, the daemon, and the parser in BGCTL. Improve the RTR logging, error handling, and version negotiation, as well as switching to autoconf 2.7.1 to generate the supplied configure scripts. Then it just lists various distributions and operating systems where OpenBGPD Portable is known to compile and run. as well as that they welcome feedback, of course, and improvements from the broader community. And thanks to all the contributors.
Cool. Next up in the BC Disc, we have two games from Celine, frequent featuree of our podcast, released in the last year. Yeah.
Yeah. She's just everywhere. She does a lot of different things.
The first game is Zedhack, kill zombies while retrieving relics in a dark dungeon. And the second one is Puffy Bubble, help Puffy to hack the planet.
Mm-hmm. And if you want to have some context, there's a link in our show notes to the BSD network on Mastodon, where this discussion from our very own Jason Topner goes out. And she replied that she published these two games already. And so that's where the connection goes to. Nice, nice one of our own Jason Topner.
But Celine did all the work.
Amazing.
Like, so okay, Jason next. Just said hello. Yeah. Celine did all the work.
he sneaked into the episode.
Hey, we've managed Chris Moore and Jason today. We've only one story left to manage.
We'll see. Ah, yes, I know. I can make a bridge. So here I found on Derek Sivers' blog, because he's been asked how he backs up, and he has been using OpenBSD, which I found out in an interview on a Tim Ferriss show, to my surprise. So this one is from his tech blog, how he backs up. And he writes, some people have asked, so here is how I do my backups. It takes me about 10 seconds per day and 5 minutes per month to maintain. Works well for me, but I'm always open to suggestions. So everyday documents, roughly 40 gigabytes. Files I use and change every day, documents, emails, code, diaries, ideas, website, accounts, pretty much everything. I have a desktop and a laptop, so I keep this with roughly 40 gigabytes directory cloned with rsync every day or so between them. Whenever I turn on one computer, I sync it from the other. Daily rsyncs to an encrypted Linux USB stick attached to the desktop. Daily rsync to an encrypted macOS USB stick attached to the laptop. Daily rsync to an encrypted ZFS SSD inside the desktop. Are you still following? And a daily rsync to OpenBSD remote attached storage at vulture.com, as described as his Tech Independence page, which I also recommend looking at. And so he has a couple of shortcuts for these rsync commands. So it's really just typing bkz or bkstick in the terminal, and it's working anyway. He does it a few times a day, especially if it's just made or saved something of value, and always right before he shuts down the computer. Then keepsakes. Roughly three terabytes, rarely accessed files he wants to keep forever, videos, photos of his kid, music, and film collection. So these are three different external 4 terabyte, 2.5 inch drives in three different formats, ZFS, OpenBSD, and macOS. Every month or so, I connect them via USB cable and rsync everything to each one of them, bringing one down to a safe deposit box downtown, taking out the one that was there from his last visit. 5 terabytes at a Hetzner storage box, I rsync remotely, and then something that I found and never knew before I read this, 4 terabytes at ZFS.rent, which is a ZFS encrypted clone. So apparently ZFS.rent is a service where you can dropship them your disks, and they pretty much they put it in the storage and they make it available, and then you can just ZFS receive from there stuff that you sent to it via ZFS send, and they just provide the open ZFS receive connection, and that's kind of interesting. Check out ZFS.rent as the URL and their terms of service and pricing, of course, and that's an interesting service. And so these 5 copies of his keepsakes in 4 different locations, so just in case. Each one also has a recent copy of his everyday documents from above, so a few minutes a month to connect the USB drives, and he only does the safe deposit box when he's going away anyway. It only takes a couple minutes. In the days of spinning platter hard drives, they used to die surprisingly often, so he likes the security of many copies, but it also helps to have some deliberately ones behind them. So one on the rare case when he's deleted something, then he rsyncs his dailies and even his monthly, then realized he needs that thing he deleted, then he knows the drive in the safe deposit box was it, since they hasn't updated that one in a couple months. And that's how cool. He does his backups.
You should write this article, Benedict.
Then
when people ask us how we do our backups,
amazing,
we
could
just post link to
post, yeah, like oh, you mean an article?
You can put it on your own blog.
Previously,
you
journal
have a
or
blog
something?
With one article, like most blogs.
That's how every blog starts at one point, and then they write a second blog post.
Some people don't even get behind
that.
Everyone's blogging experience starts like that, but most blogs start by importing the blogs from the last blog into the new blog, as if they were like original content.
Ah, so that you have a history. Ah, yeah, clever. Yeah, isn't
you've used
PST Now my blog
before.
Of sorts?
Listeners, don't let him get away with this. Ah, actually, speaking of listeners, so. Yeah. Normally at this point in the show, we would have feedback and questions and other stuff. But I think we're recording a week early. I'm definitely am. Like, yeah, I'm totally not. I'm not
yeah, you're out
here
of sync.
Here.
Yeah, sorry.
We don't have anything. Like, we've nothing here, nothing in the next show. And the only way we can have those is if you send us feedback to feedback@bsdnow.tv, because that's where we get the feedback from. But to flavor your feedback, I'd actually quite like your input, because now I'm in a house which echoes today, but JT will fix that. It's okay. And there'll be books on the walls later.
There will be
why should I run fiber in the walls? So I have fiber coming into the property. I have an ONT just sitting there. I'm going to run Cat 6A, but convince me to run fiber. Like, tell me the costs. So for Cat 6A, I get 2.5 gig drop from the ONT to the rack in the loft. And if I run a couple of strands, I can maybe get like 30 gigabit out of it if I run conduit. But if I run fiber instead, what do I have to do? Because like, I have to buy optics for a switch, but really what more do I need? I mean, I don't have to buy any optics. Yeah. I can just buy 2.5 gig switch. I should be there. But yeah, Ryan, tell me what to do. I'll design my network and I will tell you why I ignored you. And the answer will surprise you, I'm sure.
We should give a shout out to the people at Asia BSDCon that is going on at this point where we record at this very minute. I'm not sure time zone wise. Yeah, they will probably have, it's probably the second day of the Dev Summit at this point, or tomorrow is it's
and that's
the first
point.
Day.
We should probably also say that EuroBSDCon is coming up, and the call for papers for EuroBSDCon is open until the 15th of May, 2024. So if you want to talk about BSD or using BSD or using open source software, but you actually figured out how to run it on a BSD just so you could write an abstract like one of my friends did, then you should submit to EuroBSDCon. You'll get a trip to Ireland where while it will not be the color of the walls of my house, it will be the place the color of the walls of my house is named after. The office is Limerick. I didn't choose this color. It's a funny name for a paint color. I mean, I did choose Green 18, which I thought was a hilarious name for a paint color. Yeah, come to EuroBSDCon. It'll be wonderful. Benedict will be there.
Yes, meet there. I will be there. Jason tries to get there. And what better way to do a bit of
BSD Now is sponsored by Tarsnap
for a couple of days.
Everyone needs backups, and Tarsnap ensures that your backups are not only safe, but also secure. Your data is encrypted on your device before being sent to the cloud. You can be sure that only you have the ability to read your data. Tarsnap takes your data and works out what is duplicated. It then assembles the data into compressed blocks and creates them with your local private key. And this key never leaves your system. The data is then uploaded into the cloud. Even if someone is able to obtain your data in the cloud, they will not be able to decrypt it and access your files. Tarsnap is easy to use. If you can use Tar, then you can use Tarsnap. Tarsnap is prepaid, so you never have to worry about an unexpected bill. Tarsnap is fully open source, allowing you to inspect the code and make sure it does what we say it does. Tarsnap has bug bounties, so that if you find errors in the code, you can get paid for helping make the software better. With clients on all major platforms, there's no excuse not to have good backups. Go to tarsnap.com to learn more. All right, that's us. Go away.
Yeah.
Shoo. Get out of here.
All right. Thank you for listening. Until next week.